TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I'm glad to see it's you, because for a moment there, I thought you were in a Picard.
Well, you know, I can shift my look once a day, and it just seemed like the right thing to do since we were in need of more than one Renee to make sure she made it on her mission. And I look good as a blonde, I found.
Oh, that's so true, yeah. Especially with the beard.
Yes, yes, exactly. So I think I'm going to keep this look for a while. Also, the red flight suit is very slimming.
That is true as well. So yes, today we are going to conclude our look at season 2 of Star Trek Picard with the finale, Farewell. Here's a quick rundown. As the Europa mission prepares to launch, Picard and the former crew of the La Serena must race to prevent Adam Soong from changing their future. Meanwhile, Talon fulfills her ultimate mission of protecting Renee, and a special guest appears in a park. The end of Q's game arrives in a heartfelt closure to a relationship that spanned more than 3 decades as he and Jean-Luc both find closure, the penance paid. But the future isn't safe yet, as a mysterious threat of galactic proportions must be put down. And then it's drinks and 10 forward. So, Matthew, we've reached the end of the story. We're going to find out if things played out as we expected. And just to build up a little bit of suspense here, there are parts of this episode I loved, and there are parts of it that I really didn't care for very much. So let's just get started. And I did the outline, I guess, sort of in a linear nature of the story. So we've got Renee. She's about to go on the Europa mission. And the Queen warned us last time there has to be 2 Renees. And we find out what that means. So What did you think about the cryptic message, how it turned out, and Soong's role in all this?
Well, we should have known that this would be the resolution because we have seen this before. And yet, I think it was so subtly written that I didn't really think of it until we got to the point where Renee runs out the door and she runs into Soong and realized what they were playing at.
Yeah.
And I think what's beautiful about it is that before any of that happens, you know, we have the confrontation between Talon and Picard, and she tells him, look, my fate is not up to you, and other people's lives and deaths aren't your fault. It's their own choices. And, you know, we can't control who we lose, and we can't spare ourselves the pain of it. People's choices are their own to make. And so we're really bringing home everything that Picard has learned this season. And it gives Talon the opportunity to do the one thing that she's always wanted to do, which is to be able to meet Renee and come face to face with the person that she has been a guardian angel of for this many years. And so I think all of that really worked. And it comes down to the idea, too, of trust. Trust people, trust of people that you don't expect that you necessarily need to trust for the benefit of yourself and for others. So I think all of that working together was really very beautiful. And so we get our second Renee in Talon, and it also allows us to have a moment between Picard and quote-unquote Renee and Picard and Talon in a way that feels very organic and heartfelt between both of them. And you couldn't have had that if you tried to do this in an even more ridiculous or crazy way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right, because to get the conversation between Jean-Luc and Renee, it would have had to have been set up differently, or they would have had to cross a bridge that they mm-hmm. weren't willing to build because she does not know that Jean-Luc is yes. her descendant, right? And right. that was also one of the giveaways when after Talon, as Renee had been poisoned and she's running towards Jean-Luc and she calls out Picard, well, then you knew mm-hmm. for sure, even before the actual reveal, that that wasn't Renee because Renee would never call him Picard in the first place. But I thought that part of the story worked pretty well for me and it made sense, like you said. I'm surprised that we didn't see that coming because it was revealed earlier in the season that Talon can make a change like that, but it was only the ear. And so mm-hmm. I didn't really think about her being able to completely change her entire appearance, including her body as well, because it is purely Renee who's running down the hall. But yeah, it made sense. And so that was a good solution. And I think a better solution than the ones that we talked about last time, had Jean-Luc tried to take her place or Q tried to take her place or something like that. This one definitely worked better for the story.
Well, it leads to that conversation then that Talon is able to have with Picard mm-hmm. afterwards. And,
yeah.
you know, the beautiful phrase of your guilt must have saved planets by now, countless lives in trade of the one you couldn't. Absolve yourself, or the only life left unsaved will be your own. And it brings home this idea that Picard realizes that he is not responsible for his mother's death. She is responsible for her own choices. Mm-hmm. He is not responsible for all of the deaths of people under his command. They have their own choices that they've made to be there. And it's not his responsibility to try and save everyone, to be a savior figure. It is his role to be the best version of Jean-Luc Picard that he can be, and in that, work to better the universe in any way that he can. And in that betterment, he is trying to save lives, you know, and better the Federation and his crew. And yet, he can't be the one who's personally responsible for deaths being on his head in that way. And I think that there's something really special about this because it does bring to fruition everything that Talon and Q have been trying to get through Picard's mind and help him come to the other side, that he can let go of the pain that he has spent so much of his life holding on to. And that people's choices are their own to make. And he can only be responsible for his own choices. And I think that it just the whole thing was really, really powerful there. And, you know, Soon doesn't get what he wants here, which is to be the person who will live in infamy and become the most important person to mm-hmm. the humankind. Because he is not able to take responsibility for his own choices, and he's not able to get people to, I think, follow him in the same way that Jean-Luc is, right? And mm-hmm. to choose a future based on the benefit of others. I don't know if any of that makes sense, but...
Well, I think the difference between Soong and Jean-Luc is that Soong is selfish and Jean-Luc is selfless. And
yes,
sometimes you can be selfless to a fault, to where you shortchange yourself because you're always too concerned with other people. And I think that is, I don't know if that's the Jean-Luc that we've always seen throughout the Next Generation up to this point, but overall it is, I think. And at least that's the point of the story, is that that's the type of person who he became. And like you said, feels responsible for leading everyone, feels responsible for deaths of those who serve under him, as well as those who he may not know, but has been called upon to protect. Just take, you know, any random episode of The Next Generation where the Enterprise went to save a planet. And some people may feel it's a stretch in the writing of this story to suggest that he has carried all of this weight for all of these years. But I do think, as we talked about last time, after watching this, if you go back and watch The Next Generation, I think a lot of this is going to fit in well with the person that we see and with the actions that he takes. And even being standoffish to his own crew on the Enterprise D can be part of that defense mechanism of not becoming too attached to someone who you might lose because he lost his mother.
I mean, you know, he comes on to the Enterprise not liking children.
Right.
Being divorced from a whole part of his crew. You know, this the Enterprise D is full of children and families. And he walls himself off from the opportunity to interact with anybody that has a family. He tells Wesley to shut up. You know, and I think you can clearly see the why of that now, because he is a character to which is running away from his own childhood, his own actions as a child, and his own feelings of inadequacy as a child, and the inability to save the people that he loved most. And I think, you know, too, when you put that person in charge of a whole starship that has families, the feeling that he may cause that again for someone, be responsible for the death of a family member that, you know, leads to another child feeling what he's felt. And you put all these things together and you can just really see why he walls himself off. And he wants to keep himself distant from just about everybody on the Enterprise.
Yeah, yeah, it's well said. So in terms of, we'll talk about Picard more as we go along here. In terms of Soong, I think last time I said that there are moments this season where it almost feels like Soong is in the story just so Brent Spiner can be in the story. I think that the way that the resolution was written, it works for him to be there. You need someone who's really going all out to try to stop this mission from happening, and it turns out to be Soong. It could have been someone else. We do find out that the life form that Renee discovers on Io, the benefit of the life form, that's something we didn't know before. The benefit is that humans were able to use that in some way to clean up the environment so that we don't have that environment that we see in the alternate future that started out the whole story. And I guess the implication is that somehow Adam Soong, through some sort of research, would have created an organism or created something that was needed to clean the environment instead. Although, we don't see a clean environment in the future. So somewhere along the way, maybe that's the initial promise. And somewhere along the way, he assists in this shift towards a totalitarian future, perhaps because of the extreme selfish nature that we see of him.
I think he would have created a humanity that could have survived. I think that's what we would have seen.
So he's modifying the human genome.
Exactly. The same way he had with Corey. And of course, you know, Corey erases all of his files and leaves him with nothing.
He should have had two-factor authentication turned on. I mean, major rookie mistake there, Adam.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Microsoft has it. You would think Soong would have had it, but he's no Bill Gates. So Soong, though, ends up with only one thing left, which is physical files, which is the Khan project from 1996 proposal.
Yeah.
And could this be why they had the Shenzhen Convention, which means that we have seen the beginning of Khan, or that's already happened, and that kind of connects then with what he was doing with Corey and mm-hmm. where he was hoping to go. That's going to connect to what Strange New Worlds tells us. You know, you're going to have another civil war, then you will have the eugenics wars, and then that would just lead to World War III, so that they all kind of run into each other. I don't know exactly how it all works. I think timeline-wise, things feel a little messy, but it does almost feel as though they're saying there was something that happened with Khan previously.
Yeah.
And that he's going back to that, and that's what's going to lead to the augments that we see later on. But it this is the one thing where I feel like, to me, this is... it makes things a little less clear through a mirror darkly.
Yeah, well, it is muddy in the way it's presented. I think that... so, Khan, the file that he holds is Project Khan, which I think doesn't necessarily refer only to Khan, Noonien, and Singh, but refers to this eugenics program in general as Project Khan, and then Khan is the name of one of the people who is genetically enhanced. Now, that's my own reading of it. That's also maybe a bit of a stretch, but I think the way that they present all of this, you have to kind of take some leaps and figure out how it all fits together, because it doesn't quite fit fully with the timeline. I believe in the computer files that Corey's deleting that the date goes back to 1992, and then the paper file that he's holding has 1996, and that's a funding report. So that doesn't mean it's the start of the project. It's just a funding report from 1996. I think they put that date on there because that's the date that fans most remember in relation to Khan, because that's the point where the eugenics wars end, I believe. Because they were in the 1990s, but I believe running... from 92 to 96. So that date makes sense to put there. I kind of feel like that program started sometime in the early 90s, and Khan and some other humans were genetically enhanced, became superhumans, tried to take over the world. That gave us the eugenics wars. Then they were shipped off the planet, and now... in the 21st century, Adam Soong is looking back at that project and was trying to recreate those people. So there is an attempt to make it all fit together into the timeline, but it is a little bit muddy as to how it all goes. In fact, this kind of feels like an attempt to retcon suggestions earlier in the story, in fact, of eugenics and where that was all leading, to try to make it fit in.
Well... and on top of that, you know, Strange New Worlds kind of makes it seem as though it's a continuous thing that all runs together, that had different names at one time.
Yeah,
but
true.
But yet all become kind of the same thing, which in some ways would make sense when you think about the fact that this time period is not something that Star Trek history has laid out very well, because the records are so bad in this time period.
Yeah.
And so how all that works together, I'm not quite sure. And I think it's also compounded by what we learn about Rios and his family afterwards as well, which seems to not fit in with a World War III scenario either, which, again, I don't know. I really, really don't.
So, okay, let's shift gears and talk about Rios and the timeline, as I've titled it on the outline here, because I do want to talk about Rios and the fact that he decided to stay behind, because we've been predicting for a while what was going to happen with that. I like the idea that they actually had him stay behind instead of him taking Teresa and Ricardo to the future, because it's the less easy route. And also, as we said, going all the way back to the gala, when he was talking to Rafi about cigars and things, he just feels more at home. It seems like this is his place in time. And I loved this. I almost wonder if this was improvised on John Delancey's part, but I love it when Rios says, maybe this is how it always was supposed to be. Time's a funny thing. And then John Delancey points his finger and pauses and goes, yes, it is. That part to me felt almost improvised on John Delancey's part. How did you take that?
Yeah, I thought that was really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And for the reasons that you pointed out is that time is a funny thing. And that, especially with the fact that Q had played with time a little bit here.
Many times in his life, mm-hmm. even yes. involving Picard.
Yes. Well, and he said that he might have an extra power for a little gift, which mm-hmm. one of the gifts is Elnor being alive. But could it be that he has the gift of it being okay that Rios stays back in time and in a timeline to which he feels much more comfortable, where he feels like he fits because he's found this family, that Picard and Raffi and Seven and Agnes had helped him kind of create this idea of family. And now that he's found Teresa and Ricardo, he's finally found the family that he belongs with mm-hmm. in a place where he feels like he can truly make a difference in a way that he hasn't been able to in the 25th century. And so I think it's something really beautiful. Obviously, Guinan revealed that she knew the whole time. She had the picture in the bar of them, which was very cool. But it does create this interesting conundrum when it does come to the timeline. And, you know, Rios and Teresa and Ricardo and their role in the 21st, 22nd century, basically, and a world in which we know that there is going to be complete upheaval and a third world war, and how all of that fits together with what they accomplish seems to be something that does not make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to think about it too much because I think the rest of it fits so well, and it's much better than them going to the future. We have the reverse, basically, of the voyage home,
mm-hmm.
which is nice that that is what we get, but it is something to which raises more questions than it does give answers. And as a Star Trek fan, that is something that is very frustrating when it comes to playing with time. But as we know, it's a funny thing.
Time's a funny thing. Yes, it is. Absolutely. The photo that Guinan had in the bar, I loved the line. I was worried it was a bit of a spoiler having it here the whole time. It's sort of meta, right? Kind of spoiler. If we had all been watching super closely, maybe we would have seen that ourselves at some point. I have to go back and look and see. But I don't know. So the time part here, I was thinking back to the beginning of the season when people were asking, why doesn't Guinan remember Jean-Luc when they meet? I remember fans were a bit upset, and then there were all of these convoluted explanations being put about how the time travel works. And I remember that David Mack shared a whole outline with lines and everything drawn to show how the timeline was working in season two of Picard. And I want to go back now that we're at the end and look at that and see if it makes sense somehow, because I am having trouble getting my mind around any kind of clear picture about how the timelines work here, because it feels like there's no real plan as to how all this fits together, and that it's shifting with the needs of the story as the season goes along, because the implication here, because of what Rios and Teresa did in the past after Rios stayed, the fact that the chateau was all shot up when the Picard family came back in the 21st century, and then we find out at the beginning of this episode that all those bullet holes are from the battle with Soong and the Borg drones the night before. And Picard's family finds those in the future, which is sort of the past for us in terms of viewers in Star Trek. And then the fact that Guinan reveals that she knew all of this the whole time, and she remembers meeting Picard in 2024, but she couldn't tell him about it. It feels like the implication is that this is a single timeline and that this is a closed time loop within that timeline. It's something that's supposed to happen. Like, it has to happen. And it always happens. But yet, Q told Picard here that Talon always dies. This is the only timeline in which she meets Rene.
Right.
And there are references through the season to timelines. And then yet, is this a closed loop within a single timeline? It just doesn't seem like the writers ever settle on anything. And it doesn't detract from the point of the story for me, because the point of the story is all about closure and coming to terms with your past and being the best person you can be. And all of that works. That works for Rios staying in the past. It works for Talon sacrificing herself for Rene. It works for Picard, and it works for Q. And Q says, I told you that this was about redemption, yours. But before he said the word yours, I was thinking it's for Q as well. So Q might say it's for Picard, but I think it's really for both of them. And so all of that works for me. But how we get there, the time travel elements really are, I don't know. I'm not sure it all actually holds together.
So Q was the one that said that Picard was the one who brought them back to the past.
Right. Yep.
And we know that time is a tapestry, because that's what Wesley calls it as well, and that it's easy to unravel. And so I wonder if what we're seeing here is that there's that idea of, like, that by Picard going back into the past, his future, the future he was in, is now part of his past, and his ongoing future now is where he is in the past, going into what we would consider the present and or the future. And so, like you said, it kind of creates this loop that is needed.
Well, the skeleton key is also part of that closed time loop.
Yes. And it's interesting to think that Rene is most likely the one who moves back to the house and gets married. And, you know, she helps raise a family there and create more Picards. She's in that time period. And so if they take it over in the late 21st century, that would most likely be her. And so, I think you have raised a lot of really interesting questions, which the show does not give us really any answers to.
No.
And part of the reason is, like you said, the thematic elements of this show are more about creating whole characters than they are necessarily about whole timelines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I am going to continue to try to wrap my head around this a little bit, just because I love time travel, anything involving time. I've always found very interesting since I was a kid. So I like trying to unravel it all. I'll give a quick plug here to our friends Mike Schindler and Max Hegel, who used to be on the network for many years. They did commentary Trek Stars, and they also do a podcast these days called Elementary Temporal Mechanics, because Max especially loves dissecting time travel, not just in Star Trek, but in movies in general. Now, I have not listened to this episode yet because I didn't want to listen to it before we discussed, but I'm going to go listen. And the two of them are discussing whether the time travel in the season of Star Trek Picard works, and Max does these very elaborate diagrams of time travel himself, which are interesting. So if you're interested in that, go to filmdamagepod.com. That's the website of their podcast, and they do these little sub things called elementary temporal mechanics, and I'm interested to find out what they say about it.
One of the things that I was thinking of is the way that Seven finally finds full acceptance of herself. Mm-hmm. And it's a real reminder that even the terrible things in our past can be redeemed with time, perspective, and how they lead us to being right where we need to be, the same way the interrogator was right where he needed to be when the Vulcans showed up. And that experience led him to be able to trust Picard. And, you know, Guinan even tells him that as well. Maybe you were here for such a time as this. And so that the timeline, all of these things need to happen in the way that they do so that people can come to the emotional realizations that they need to at just the right time, at just the right place to make an impact in history. And therefore, the timey-wiminess of it all is a part of the plan that Q has for acceptance for Jean-Luc, as well as all of these other characters, you know, coming into full acceptance of themselves in a way that then allows them to impact the history of the future for the better.
Yeah. And the timey-wimey nature of it is something I think as Star Trek fans, we can't complain about too much, given everything that we've seen in Star Trek over the years. You know, you and I are doing Warp 5, where we're doing the Enterprise rewatch, and when we get to Season 3, we're really going to be delving into some of this stuff with time as well. And there is the scientific idea that there is no past, present, or future, really, right? It's our perception of it. And I think in Star Trek, maybe that holds true often, because if you think about everything that's ever been done to time in Star Trek, it's who knows what is the past and what's the future and what is what timeline. So it all supports the story anyway.
Time is on my side. Yes, it is.
That reminds me that the third season of For All Mankind is starting in June. Looking forward to that. All right. Okay, so let's move on. And because we're talking about time and we're talking about the tapestry, and you mentioned Wesley, we got this unexpected cameo with Wesley returning and recruiting Corey to become a traveler. And he talked to her about how the universe is a grand tapestry, as you said. He told her it's flawless, it's fragile, it is exquisite, yet it is somehow always a thread's pull away from total annihilation. A star is born, but a ship is lost. A new species thrives, but a civilization collapses. Knowing when to step in, that's the tricky part. Now, his description is what I was just saying, perfect for Star Trek, in that, yeah, it is always a thread's pull away from falling apart. But this idea of knowing when to step in, and here are the writers trying to connect the travelers with Aegis, Gary Seven, the observers, this organization, making the travelers the overseers of Aegis. And I did a little bit of looking after that to see if that's established anywhere, but it feels like it's not a connection that I would have made before. What did you think about his appearance? And then what did you think about this idea that the travelers are the ones who are guiding Gary Seven and Talon and these people?
I am not a massive fan of Will Wheaton. And I did not think the scene was well acted by him. it came off way too earnest and not natural.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But the most interesting part about this is, you know, we've gone back and forth as to why Talon is a Romulan. Why does she look like Laris? Well, if the travelers are the supervisors, are the ones who send out the supervisors, they're the watchers, it explains exactly why Talon is a Romulan who's sent to watch over Rene Picard. And the travelers know her connection with Picard, Jean-Luc, and that in this grand tapestry, in the lesson he is going to be learning, that having this person have this connection is going to make a big difference in his life, into him being able to finally accept himself, choose himself, be worthy enough of himself, and then worthy of somebody else to choose him to be loved. And so to me, that's where this made the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
That the travelers are connected with the supervisors, and why we would have, you know, Talon being who she is and looking the way that she does, and that connection there then with Jean-Luc. So,
mm-hmm. Well, I love that explanation, because that really makes it work a lot better for me, because the way it's described in the episode, it just feels like a fan service moment where, okay,
yes,
we're going to throw Wesley in because fans want to see Wesley, and there's no connection to the story. And what we know about the travelers, what we know about the supervisors, the Aegis organization, they're very much separate. And connecting those dots felt a little bit like digging into Star Trek lore for something that maybe you could connect. But the way you describe it here, actually, that works quite well, and I don't have a problem with them connecting the two organizations or the two groups of people or the two species. I mean, Aegis are various species, and the travelers are as well, right? Because they're, as I understand, the travelers, from what we've known in past Star Trek, when they identify someone who has the potential to become a traveler, they kind of watch over that person, and then they invite them in, which is what happened to Wesley. So the organizations have similarities in that sense. And if it's a trickle down from the travelers to the supervisors, that would make perfect sense as well. So I think that works pretty well. As for the delivery, the acting in the scene, to me, it just felt like Will Wheaton. So you said it didn't feel natural. To me, it felt natural for Will Wheaton. Like, I felt like I was watching Will Wheaton talk, not Wesley Crusher. I don't know. The scene was okay for me, but it was the idea that Corey would be recruited as a traveler. I know, it just seemed, I've been wondering, what are they going to do with Corey? And there we have it. I am amazed that they were able to keep that appearance under wraps until the episode aired, since they couldn't keep other things like the casting of Robert April under wraps just days before the episode aired for Strange New Worlds. And they've already revealed that they've cast James T. Kirk for season 3 of that show. So they love to spill the beans on everything, but they managed to keep this one under wraps. So good on them. All right. Anyway, let's move on and talk about maybe my favorite part of the episode, which is the death of Q. It's not my favorite part because Q dies, but it's my favorite part because we get this exchange between Q and Jean-Luc in the Solarium, and it's such a heartfelt performance by John DeLancey, and the message that he has for Jean-Luc, I think, so perfectly summed up the entire season and the story that was being told.
I thought that this was really well done. What he tells Jean-Luc is so beautiful. And that the reason that he had done this is because he's dying, and he's dying alone, and he doesn't want that for Jean-Luc. and he knows the reasons that John Luke has suffered the way he has, and he wants him to overcome those, to unshackle himself from the past and give himself a future so that he, unlike Q, will not die alone. And with what Q says, too, he says, look, even gods have their favorites, and you've always been one of mine. And basically saying, I love you. I care about you. And that's why I'm doing this. And I do think it's his way as well of paying a little penance for all the trouble he has put Picard through. Mm-hmm. And he's putting a lot of things that he's responsible for as Q right, especially not only with Picard, but also with the Federation and the Borg. And by creating this scenario, he has righted a massive wrong that they were not ready for. And so this goes a lot farther than just him saving Picard and his emotional self. This has everything to do with Q, I think, helping save the Federation and making it better for the long run, since he won't be here to watch over it.
Mm-hmm. That's another excellent point about why the Borg are included in the season, and also the latter part of this episode. Well, the beginning of the season with Stargazer, and then the latter part of this episode where they have to work together with the Borg and the Borg want to assist the Federation. Yeah, going back to the fact that he put humans in the path of the Borg prematurely in the first place, and that's something that he wants to right. Maybe he didn't feel that way until near the end of his life, but then he realized that that was a drastic thing. The fact that he created the situation and then they're back in the past, and then the Borg get back into the past in 2024, at times felt like, oh, Q has done it again, and it's going to be even worse this time. But actually, it turned out well. I don't know if he knew it was going to turn out well, but I kind of feel like the things he says at the end suggest that he did know how it was all going to turn out.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about this is that you can see that Q has been involved with humanity and with Picard specifically all of these years on purpose, and that his desire is to leave the universe maybe just a little bit better than when he found it, and he does that by helping save a man's emotional existence that has saved countless planets and lives, but at the same time, helps save the galaxy by taking what was once a malevolent force and turning it into a benevolent force for good. And he does that with Picard. He does that with the Borg. And I think it's just makes for really exciting stories coming up next.
Yeah, yeah. I think what he told Picard, well, first of all, the fact that he's dying alone is one of those unanswered questions of the season where you do want to know more, right? Has he been cast out of the continuum? Why did he lose his powers at one point? Was it simply because he's dying? They come and go. He has his powers back at the end. So it's a bit of it works for the story. It works really well, the idea that he's dying alone and he doesn't want that for Picard. Why he's dying alone, maybe that's going to be a follow-up novel to the season, mm-hmm. perhaps. The thing that he said to Picard, though, I thought it summed up our lives so well. I mean, it's for me anyway, spot on about humans. He says, your griefs, your pains fix you to moments in the past long gone. You're like butterflies with your wings pinned. My old friend, forever the boy who, with the errant turn of a skeleton key, broke the universe in his own heart. No more. You are now unshackled from the past. As I leave you free. That line, I thought, was wonderful. And then the other part, And he asks Picard, of course, if you thought about destroying the key? You weren't going to put it there. But what if the key wasn't there? Would you have grown up with your mother? Would that boy have grown up with his mother? And would the shame instantly lift? But ultimately, the outcome was accepting yourself. And that's what opens up Picard. Now, to transition to the next thing that I want to talk about, we have to stick with Q for a moment, because in this part that I just mentioned about your griefs and your pains, Picard asks him, but why does all this matter? Is something going to happen for which I will be required? And Q says, must it always have a galactic import? Universal stakes, celestial upheaval, isn't one life enough? And I thought, wow, that is a great ending. It's so wonderful in modern Star Trek to hear those words. Isn't one life enough? Does everything have to be the end of life as we know it? The end of the galaxy, the end of the universe. And then we jump back to the Stargazer. As I said last week, I expected we would do this. And yeah, it makes perfect sense in terms of the story structure that we jump back. So I know they have to do it. But what do they jump back to? They jump back to this massive galactic threat that has to be stopped, and it requires the Borg and a grid of Federation starships pushing back some kind of energy burst, and there's no explanation as to what it is. And this is the part of the episode I really didn't care for, because I felt like they said something profound and then they canceled it in the next scene by going back to the generic ending where, oh my gosh, we have to stop the galaxy from ending again. Except this time, they don't even have an explanation. Even Queen Agnes says we don't know what's going on.
Well, it seems to be the creation of a transwarp conduit, possibly.
Yeah, and that is explained
in says,
the episode.
She says, that it's a piece of the puzzle whose final image is unclear.
Yeah.
And a threat. And that's why the Borg are there. They realize that they need a friend. And so, obviously, all of that plays into everything that we've seen this season. And yet, you are right in, I think, the underlying tone, in the sense of, do we really need a galactic threat like this? But it seems to obviously be as well setting up what's going to come next, next season.
Yeah, I think it may be. Yeah.
Seven being made a captain, and the Borg being the guardians at the gate here. And so I wasn't thrown by it too much, but I do very much understand your point. And it does seem like, though, too, that everyone being free of the shackles of the past enables them then to do something that they would have never been able to do by themselves unless they had been through this journey together, which is where it's that universal stakes, it's the celestial upheaval, but it was the internal upheaval that happened in all these characters that brought them to a place where they could trust one another to pull this off. So it's a messy thing. But I ended up kind of liking it because of how it played into the thematic elements we've been working with all of these characters.
Yeah.
It's just not clean.
Yeah. Well, again, those are good points. And I think that you have to dig for that and tie it in that way to make it settle into the story in a way that it feels okay. I'm going to watch it again now with that in mind and see how I feel about it. I've watched the episode three times and I still haven't come around to liking that part of the episode. It's a necessary part because that's how the whole thing started. If it had started in some other way, not having them be on the Stargazer, we wouldn't have to jump back to the Stargazer. But it all started with this unknown rift forming and then the Borg coming through. And so, yeah, you had to go back here. I also think for me, it would have been a little bit less disappointing if Q hadn't delivered those lines right beforehand. Because it's like you're being led to one place and then, nope, we're back to this other spot. And I think it also stems from my overall disappointment that this is how every season of live-action modern Star Trek ends, with some kind of cataclysm. And I like the stories in Star Trek that are more introspective and are really focused on the characters, and they don't have to be these, you know, galactic crises every time. But then we get to the final scene where we're back with Guinan. So to wrap up here, we have an item on our outline called Coda, which wraps up a few different things, but mainly it's the visit back to Guinan. And I did want to get your thoughts on last things like Seven getting her moment in the captain's chair, Elnor being alive, Guinan revealing to Jean-Luc that she knew all along what was going on. And then we talked already about a bit about what Teresa and Rios did and what Ricardo did as well. And then we get the final scene with Laris. And I keep thinking in my mind that if we didn't have to have that Stargazer scene, that it would have been a really nice and smooth transition from Q's final words to the scene with Guinan. What do you think?
I love the fact that Seven gets the commission to be a captain. We've already talked about that. And then I think it makes sense because she takes over Rios's captaincy, and I'm not sure he would have wanted anybody else in that command chair.
Well, Rios loves to pass his ships along to Seven, Matthew.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. The fact that Elnor is alive, I think we all knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
The gift to Rafi in that he's alive is wonderful. The whole conversation with Guinan about her knowing and her relationship with Jean-Luc, her relationship with Rios and Teresa and Ricardo and Rene Picard, all that was kind of interesting. But again, that kind of feels weird timeline-wise.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the biggest thing here to me was Picard finally opening his heart to Laris and they don't kiss. What the heck? Why is there no kiss? This show should have ended with a kiss, Chris.
It should have. I was thinking I knew they were going to end up together at the end like that, have a scene of the two of them together. That just, I think, easy to predict. But I was thinking that they might be back out in the same setting where they were at the beginning. Again, it makes sense for them to be in the Solarium because so much of what happened to Picard in his childhood happened there. And that's the appropriate place for him to finally overcome that and open himself up. But also, had they been back outside together in the original setting, it would have worked well. And then maybe you would have gotten your kiss.
But all in all, I mean, it's not a bad coda. And I think it follows up well what just happened on the Stargazer, that these people are back on Earth and needing some rest and a conversation together. And Picard, you know, reminding them that, yes, we're family and we are here together and we will continue to be together. And what's going to be interesting is seeing which part of this family then is in the third season.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, any final thoughts, and what's your rating for this episode? And then, you know, final thoughts on the season as a whole as well.
I think overall, you know, I really enjoyed the season. I thought it was well done. I'm so glad we got an opportunity to talk through it. And I would give, you know, this episode probably an 8 out of 10 misplaced Rioses. The thematic work in this season is so good that it covers a multitude of sins, timeline sins, that is. And so I'm very happy with the season, and I'm very happy to have taken the journey, and now I can't wait to see what happens in season 3. Chris, what are your thoughts on the season and this final episode?
Well, the final episode, I'll just sum up quickly because we've talked about so many of the points. Overall, I really enjoyed it. There is that bit at the end that I feel doesn't work as well, but I think your explanations help it sit better with me than it did before we had the discussion today, so that's great. I'll give the episode 7 funding reports. And as for the whole season, yeah, the season as a whole, I really loved because they decided to really focus on the characters. I've seen some people say that this season is too concerned with plot and not enough with characters. And I wonder what they're watching or what they're missing, they're not connecting with, because if anything, I think the season is more concerned with characters than plot, to the point that some of the plot doesn't hold together, as we talked about today with time travel, because mm-hmm. they're moving the target as they need to follow the struggles of these characters. And so as these characters work to find themselves, I sometimes feel like the writers are finding new landing spots for time as well. And in that sense, it's a bit of a loosey-goosey story. But as a character story, I think it was excellent. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm interested to see if the Borg situation does set up what's going on in the third season. And if not, I'm certainly interested to see what Jean-Luc is like in the third season, especially as he's reunited with his former crew now that he's completely opened himself up. All right. Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Farewell, as well as all of season 2 of Star Trek Picard. There are many ways for you to share those thoughts with us. Perhaps the easiest is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. If you're already a member, you know what to do. But if not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group for listeners, so please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there for this episode, and you can share your comments with fellow listeners and us in the comment threads on that post and extend the conversation beyond the podcast. You can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Artificial Tango. And that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us in social media, on Twitter, Instagram, everywhere. Our username is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not, you know, having a drink with Guinan, talking about all those cool things from the past that she knows about and you don't, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, when that is not happening, you can find me wondering about them all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, I'm on every single show we're doing right now, except for Interphase.
you're and so everywhere. You're the Jeffrey Combs of Trek FM.
I try. So please look for me in all of those places. And then, of course, I'm on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is a completed show with Drea Kaufman called Owl Post. We talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then over on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. And Chris, when, you know, you're not trying to hug it out with Q before he evaporates into nothing, where can people find you?
Yeah, Q, he has quite a squeeze. It's like all the power of the universe in that squeeze right there. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me here on the network, talking DS9 with you on the Orb, Enterprise with you on Warp 5, Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. There's Interphase, as you mentioned, and I'm in lots of episodes in the back catalog, and I'm always working on things behind the scenes. So check those out if you want to hear more of my thoughts on Star Trek. And if you'd like to chat with me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere on social media, but Twitter is where I am most active, and I'd love to chat with you there. If you would like to help us keep this show and all the shows that we've mentioned here in the closing and the entire network going, we could definitely use your help. If you'd like to find out how to get involved, how to help us out, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And we really appreciate everyone who is helping us right now, including our associate producer for this show, Cornelia Rotner. Cornelia, thank you so much for your support. And thank you to everyone who is helping us keep the network going. Well, Matthew, we've reached the end of season two, which means for right now, that's going to be the end of episodes of The Artificial Tango. We'll probably come back from time to time with an episode here or there, covering various aspects of Picard, talking to people. But we'll return in earnest when season three rolls around, whenever that is, and of course talk about that together as well.
Chris, I'm so excited to make that happen. So make it so.